This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. In the U.S., thousands of sick Americans are awaiting an organ transplant. Indeed, globally, demand for organs outstrips supply in almost every country in the world. The process for matching and procuring a healthy organ from a voluntary donor in the U.S. can take years, and at best, months. And that's where transplant tourism, as it's called, has become a trend. That's where people travel to a foreign country, like China, to have an organ transplant. But in the past decade, the Chinese government has acknowledged that organs for transplants done in China come overwhelmingly from Chinese prisoners. This, of course, raises all kinds of concerns and questions. American physicians say these types of transplants run risks of disease, poor organ matching, and unhealthy donors. The issue also raises serious ethical and moral concerns, concerns that impact not only global health standards and practices, but could likely impact political relations between China and the U.S. as well. About a week ago, some of the people who've led investigations that revealed China's prisoner organ transplant practices spoke at the University of Utah. They spoke in depth about this disturbing practice and how many persecuted members of China's Falun Gong group have fallen victim. Today, we're airing the bulk of their talk, which was recorded on September 19th, 2014, with an audience of students and physicians at the Hinckley Institute of Politics.
Because of my human rights work and my refugee work, I knew about the persecution of Falun Gong in China more or less from the time it started.
This is David Mattis. He's a lawyer based in Winnipeg, Canada, and has published several books and articles about transplant tourism, organ harvesting, and human rights issues in China.
I knew that Falun Gong was a set of exercises with a spiritual foundation started in 1992 with the teachings of Li Hongzhi, that it was initially encouraged by the Communist Party, but then repressed in 1999 after it got too popular. Now, a woman with the pseudonym Annie made a public statement in Washington, D.C. in March 2006 that her ex-husband had been harvesting corneas of Falun Gong practitioners in Sujiatin Hospital in Shenyang City in Liaoning Province from 2003 to 2005. She said other doctors had been harvesting other organs. She said the Falun Gong practitioners were killed through the organ extraction and their bodies were cremated. She said the bodies were sold at high prices to transplant tourists. The Chinese government immediately denied what Annie said. Annie's statement and the Chinese government denial were two of the many human rights stories which pop up on my computer every day. Shortly after Annie made her statement, a Washington-based NGO, the Coalition to Investigate Persecution Against the Falun Gong, asked me and David Kilgore to investigate whether what Annie said was true. Now, it's common for me to be asked to assist in human rights work. This request, though, was unusual because of the difficulties it posed. Though I knew full well that in China, practitioners of the exercises of Falun Gong were being persecuted, that did not mean they were being persecuted in this particular way, being killed for their organs. The coalition who'd asked us to do the research didn't give us any data or any money or any instructions. For my part, I had no idea whether what Annie said was true or not. Her story presented a conundrum. How was it possible to know whether what Annie was saying was true or not? The question was not just how do we prove what Annie said if it was true. The question was also how do we disprove what Annie said if it's not true. The situation the testimony of Annie presented was this. She was saying that there were no victims to interview because the victims were all killed. There was no bodies to autopsy because the bodies were all cremated. There was no crime scene to visit since the crime scene and operating theater would have been cleaned up immediately afterwards. There were no accessible records since what records there are belong to the Chinese hospitals, prisons, labor camps, and detention centers, none of which are publicly available. The sole witnesses available were perpetrators who were unlikely publicly to confess to crimes that they had committed. The question whether what Annie said was true was difficult enough that it was unlikely to get much of a response either from human rights NGOs or intergovernmental organizations or the media. Human rights NGOs, though they have some research capacity, are for the most part campaign organizations. They look for easily verifiable stories, not just because it makes research easier, but also because it makes campaigning easier. Intergovernmental organizations have little internal research capacity and tend to rely heavily on the work of NGOs. As for the media, they cater to readers, listeners, and viewers with short attention spans. If a story cannot be told quickly and simply, it normally cannot be told at all. However, addressing a claim of human rights violations with little or no evidence is a situation to which I'm quite accustomed. That is, in fact, my daily work as a refugee lawyer. Refugee claimants come to my office with stories of horror, the clothes on their back, and little else. They, of course, have the advantage that they are witnesses to what happened to them, yet often they are faced with skeptical refugee judges who suspect that they are economic migrants making up stories in order to move from a poor country to a rich country. Are the story these clients tell true or not true? Answering that sort of question is not that different from assessing the truth of the story Annie told. I am often faced with the task of assisting my clients in attempting to establish to the satisfaction of one of these skeptical judges the truth of the stories they tell. Often, when victims or their representatives come to me for general assistance to combat a human rights situation abroad, I can send them off to the media or the local member of parliament or a human rights NGO or a UN human rights mechanism. I realized, though, that for what Annie said, that would not do. If something was going to be done, David Kilgore and I were going to have to do it ourselves. But the question became, what was that something to be? I began constructing imaginary evidentiary trails, trails that would either prove or disprove all the allegations. In doing so, I followed four principles. One was never to rely on rumor or hearsay. If someone told me what somebody else told him or her, like Annie telling us what her husband told her, I put the information to one side. Second, I refused to rely on information from perpetrators. In the course of the work that David Kilgore and I were doing, some perpetrators did come forward to offer testimony subject to various conditions. I turned all such offers aside, partly because I wanted to have nothing to do with perpetrators, and partly because I have in the past in other contexts found perpetrator information to be self-exonerating and unreliable. Third, I insisted that all information I saw, anybody else could see. No one after our work was done had to rely on our conclusions. Anyone who wanted to do so could look at the information we considered and come to his or her own conclusions. Fourth, I was determined not to draw conclusions either one way or the other based on one bit of evidence only. Rather, I intended to have regard to all the evidence before coming to any conclusion. Now, at the end of all this, following those principles, the conclusion was that Falun Gong practitioners have been and are being killed for their organs. Now, I mean, this was 2006, it's now 2014, 8 years later. In the course of those 8 years, I've done two reports and a book with David Kilgore called Bloody Harvest. As a result of our report, an NGO was established called Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting, and the founder was Torsten Trey. I've co-edited a book of essays with Torsten Trey on the issue. So there's a lot of material out there, and it would take me far too long to go through all the evidence, which led to the conclusions to which we came. But I'll mention a few bits. One is that we had investigators making calls to hospitals throughout China, claiming to be relatives of patients needing transplants, asking if the hospitals had organs of Falun Gong practitioners for sale, on the basis that since Falun Gong through the exercises are healthy, the organs would be healthy. Well, we obtained on tape, transcribed and translated admissions throughout China that yes, come, we have Falun Gong organs for sale in about 15% of the calls. And the actual calls themselves, if you want, you can listen to them in Chinese, of course, on the internet, and we have transcripts of them as well in English. Secondly, we talked to people like Mr. Liu here who were got out of detention and out of China. And they told us a number of things. One, like Mr. Liu, that Falun Gong practitioners were systematically blood tested and organ examined while in detention. Other detainees were not. The blood testing and organ examination could not have been the result, had not have been for the health of the Falun Gong practitioners, since they had been tortured, and it would have been necessary for organ transplants, because you need blood type compatibility and even ideally tissue type compatibility for transplants. Now, Ethan Gutman, who was somebody who originally interviewed us as a journalist when we did our report, eventually got into the issue himself in great detail and re-interviewed many of the people that we interviewed and going through the details of their medical examinations and also interviewed other victim groups, Uyghurs, Tibetans, and House Christian, Eastern Lightning House Christians, and he wrote a book on that issue, which has just come out in August of this year, about a month ago, called The Slaughter. Another thing that the Falun Gong practitioners told us was that while they were coming from all over the country originally when Falun Gong was banned to protest the banning, they were systematically arrested. Those who revealed their identities to their captors would be shipped back to their home localities. Their immediate environment would be implicated in their Falun Gong activities and penalized. To avoid harm to people in their locality, many detained Falun Gong practitioners declined to identify themselves. The result was a large Falun Gong practitioner population in detention whose identities the authorities did not know. As well, no one who knew them knew where they were. This population is a remarkably undefended group of people, even by Chinese standards. The population provided a ready source for harvested organs.
David Mattis is a lawyer based in Winnipeg and the co-author of several books and reports that document China's systemic harvesting of organs from prisoners and Falun Gong practitioners.
If we take a step back, we look at transplant medicine's history, and we'll just give a little bit of a history lesson.
This is Dr. Damon Noto. He's an attending physician at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey and a spokesperson for Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting. Noto has spoken in various media outlets on forced organ harvesting and on ongoing human rights abuses in China.
First transplant, actually, that was successful of human tissue actually occurred in 1883. It was by a Swiss surgeon. But the first successful organ transplant from one person to another actually occurred in Brigham and Women's, Harvard, in 1954 by a guy named Joseph Murray. Does anybody know why? And before that, there was many attempts to try and take an organ from one person to another, but all failed. Does anybody have any idea why this one succeeded? Are you in the medical field? Oh, okay, go ahead. Yeah, that's right. It was an identical match. So the genetics and everything, there was no resistance. The organ was accepted. But then from 54, it went over a decade before actual legislation started to come into place that talked about what's an ethical transplant, what are our guidelines, how do we handle things. And the reason I have this slide is to convey to you that although the United States now is the number one in organ transplant in the world, it took decades to get there. And that took public awareness, public campaigns, physicians talking to the public. Now we have this system, right? If I talk about here, the donor card, it's accepted in every state in the country. And if you want to be a donor, you can sign up as a donor card. And it's pretty much accepted anywhere. If you got into an accident in California and you said, I'd like to give my organs, it's now acceptable, you can give your organs. This is something that had to be brought to the public. It took campaigning, it took awareness, and really explaining to people the benefits of this new science in transplant medicine. So it wasn't overnight. And what happened was the U.S. came up with something in the Western world that the World Health Organization adopted these guiding principles. And there are 11 of them. And I'm not going to go into too much detail because the next lecturer will. But some of the basics were, it had to be voluntary. It couldn't be for money. Had to be free consent, well-informed. Had to be traceable. You had to know who was giving it, who was receiving it. And it had to be transparent. And what I like to say about transparency is it means it needs to be open to the public. It needs to be open to someone who's a third party. You can go in there and say, is what you're doing legal or not? Is it fair or not? You know, a lot of people had the concern when transplant first came out that it was going to be for the rich and that the poor people were going to be abused because people who had money would go to the poor and pay them. So what happened was they said, you know what, we have to make this open so that we can see what's going on. And that's why these guiding principles came into effect.
Damon Noto is a physician and a spokesman for Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. Stay with us. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. A week ago, a group of physicians and human rights activists spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about a disturbing medical practice that's been ongoing in China since the early 2000s. That's the practice of executing Chinese prisoners in order to take their organs for transplantation. While Chinese government officials have acknowledged this practice goes on, they claim the prisoners are convicted criminals sentenced to death, and that they have consented before execution to the use of their organs for transplant. Dr. Damon Noto of the group Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting continues his talk.
China is a completely different situation, and it's challenging the way the world looks at transplant medicine. And I say that because if you look at the history of China's transplant program is completely different. So what happened was in 1984, China's Supreme Court passed a law that said it was okay to take organs from executed prisoners. And that law was in effect, but still in the 90s and 80s, not that many transplants took place. And in fact, from 1977 to 1999, if you look at the numbers, there was only about 230 or so transplants, liver transplants, so about 10 a year up until 1999. But something changed after 2000, and that number literally exploded. And if you look at their transplant history, after 2000, the number of centers just quadrupled. And within a few years, 3, 4, 5 years, they went from about 100 transplant centers to 500 to 600. There were transplant centers popping up all over the place. And medical tourism started to boom after 2000. Chinese hospitals were all over the web promoting their centers, saying, if you come to China, pay a certain amount of money, we'll get you an organ and we'll get it to you very quickly. And within about 5 years, China went from not even a top 100 country in transplant to number 2. And if you look at the numbers this year, they might even be number 1. And if you look at some of the graphs from some hospitals, this was from Tianjin, you can see after 2000, the numbers for liver and kidney transplants just exploded. And then if you look at the number of centers, they also exploded. In the U.S., just to give an example, the U.S., we have about 200 centers, and we're supposed to be the top. If you look at China's own numbers, the amount of transplants also exploded. And if you look at numbers before 99 to about 2004, 2005, they went from doing below 1,000 to over 10,000 a year. And these are China's numbers. And this is a snapshot from a website in the early 2000s. If you look on the left-hand corner, fast transplant surgery at a world-class facility. This was a Shanghai hospital who was advertising on the internet. At some point, it seemed like they almost had an unlimited organ supply. They started calling up transplant doctors from around the world saying, come to China, let us give you a demonstration of how far we've come. And the problem is they used to tell these doctors, when are you going to come? You're going to come 2 months, 3 months, you're going to come in the morning, you're going to come in the afternoon. And this is something that the transplant surgeons were very taken back by, because how do you schedule these transplants? And everywhere else around the world, people are waiting for organs. Someone passes away, it's quickly done. But in China, they were asking them, when do you want to come? I'll give an example. The chair of the Swiss National Foundation was in Beijing, and he was quoted as saying he was asked whether he wanted to come in the morning or the afternoon to see a heart transplant. And he was shocked. He was like, I can tell you what time. And he decided not to go because he realized someone was going to be killed around the time that he decided to do the transplant. And at some point, they were, like I said, organs everywhere. One time they were advertising in their own newspaper that they had 20 free organs to just give away. And that if you came to their hospital, they would give 20 people free transplant surgery. The interesting thing was, although transplant doctors in other countries started to become aware of a situation in China that was unusual, most of the time, China was a black box. China denied the fact that they were using prisoners or executed prisoners for their source of organs. And then in 2001, a doctor, a transplant surgeon from China, Wang Guoji, he came to the U.S. and he came in front of Congress and he testified and he said, you know what, this is happening in China today. We're executing prisoners in large numbers and we're using their organs in transplants. And you know what? The U.S. government said it's hard to believe. We'll ask China. China at the time, their foreign affairs said, these are very vicious and harmful lies. And China strictly prohibits the sale of human organs for transplant purposes only from voluntary donors, not from executed prisoners. So completely denied it. And it wasn't until very later, until about 2005, that from the international community pressure that they finally came out and admitted that executed prisoners was the main source. So to take a perspective, if you look at other countries around the world that have a successful transplant system, there's two things you need to have in place. One is a public organ donation program, like we talked about before, and one is a national distribution program, which means if you got into a car accident in Utah and someone needed your organ in New Jersey, they can quickly get that organ, take it to another state, and transplant that organ very quickly. Organs have a very short half-life. After they're taken out of the body, you have hours to days to get those organs into somebody. You can't just freeze them and stockpile them. These organs are very sensitive, and they need to be used very quickly. So to be successful, you have to have a lot of people who say, all right, if I die, you can take my organs. So in the U.S., we have about 100 million. The U.K. has about 18 million. In China, every time they've tried to set up a public organ donation program, it's failed, and miserably. It's never really gotten out of, and David could correct me, but probably below 1,000 or 2,000 people have signed up for their organ. And there's reasons for that, cultural reasons, and probably get into the next lecturer, but there's reason Chinese people aren't very keen on becoming organ donors. So that leads to the question that the medical transplant community was saying, all right, where is the organs coming from then? If they have no public organ donation program and no system to get the organs around, where did they come from? Well, in 2005, China's Vice Minister of Health at the time, Huang Jiefu, stated 95% of the organs we're transplanting today come from executed prisoners. And he repeated that in a transplant conference in Spain in March of 2010, where he said, again, over 90% of the organs. This is China's own people saying this. So, and then in that same conference, I'll just give you, he gave numbers, official Chinese numbers about how many kidneys and how many livers. And in 2008, if you look at the kidney numbers, 6,200. 2009, 6,400. And if you looked at the total numbers, it was over 10,000 each year. These are not verifiable numbers. So I'll get into that in a second. But these are the best numbers we could conclude because this is what China is saying that they're doing. So China today is the only country in the world that their government publicly condones and allows the organ harvesting from executed prisoners. This is despite every major medical organization in the world saying that we shouldn't be doing this. So the American Medical Association, the World Medical Association, the International Transplant Society, all of them have very strong guidelines and bylines that says you should not be using prisoners to give their organs for transplant. And in fact, the world, and China is, just so we know, China is a member of all those. So to be a member of these organizations, you have to say you agree to these things and you're going to follow by that, of which China does not follow any of them. And if you look at, like I said before, the ethical standards, the one thing that's very important is that the public has to be allowed to have independent evaluation of your organ donation program. That's something that does not exist in China today.
That's Damon Noto with the group Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting.
The party has engaged in a prolonged, persistent, vitriolic national and international campaign of incitement to hatred against Falun Gong.
Again, this is David Mattis.
This campaign has prompted their marginalization, depersonalization, and dehumanization in the eyes of many Chinese nationals. To their jailers, Falun Gong are not human beings entitled to respect for human rights and dignity. So that's a second evidentiary trial of these practitioners. The third was the patients. We talked to the patients who went to China for transplants and then came back. And what they told us was First, that waiting times for transplants of organs in China are days and weeks. Everywhere else in the world, waiting times are months and years. A short waiting time for a deceased donor transplant, particularly for heart or lung or liver, means that somebody's being killed for that transplant. Second thing that they told us is there's a heavy militarization of transplantation in China. Hospitals with a ready supply of available organs are often military hospitals. Even in civilian hospitals, the doctors performing operations are often military personnel. The military have a common culture with prison guards and readier access to prisoners as organ sources than civilian hospitals and civilian personnel do. In China, the military is a conglomerate business, and the sale of organs is a prime source of funds. Military hospital websites used to boast, before we publicized it and they took it down, used to boast this fact. They have since taken down the boast, but we've archived this information so that independent researchers can still see them. Third thing patients told us is that there's an inordinate secrecy surrounding transplantation in China. The names of doctors are not identified. Patients are not allowed to bring their own doctors with them. Before our 2006 report came out, Chinese doctors used to provide letters to patients indicating the treatment given and counseled. The letters ceased after the publication of our report. So that was a third trail. A fourth was that the standards and mechanisms which should be in place to prevent the abuse are not in place, either in China nor abroad. International organ transplant abuse should be treated like international child sex tourism, an offense everywhere with extraterritorial effect. However, so far that is not the case, and that's a point I'll come back to later. On the one hand, we have organ transplant abuse, which is possible without legal consequence. On the other hand, we have huge money to be made from this abuse, as well as desperate people in need of transplants. The combination is a recipe for victimization of the vulnerable. Standards and mechanisms to prevent the abuse need to be introduced. The Chinese transplant system used to actually publish the price list for transplants before our report came out, and after it came out, they took the price list down. But there was brokers advertising transplantation into China through websites until the last one we saw was May of this year, and again, they've been archived, and you can actually see them through the Wayback Archive on the internet. And the business is still going. It's just a lot more undercover. And yet another evidentiary trail is the transplant numbers, which just don't add up. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the transplant numbers because Damon Noto is going to speak about them, but that represents another evidentiary trail we followed. Now, going through all the relevant evidence to come to an informed conclusion, either one way or other, on the killing of Falun Gong for their organs is a time-consuming task, and it may be unrealistic to expect everyone in the issue to do that. I have to commend Kirk Allison. He did it. and was able to come to similar conclusions, as you'll see. But I don't expect everyone who's interested in the issue to go through all that, although I would be pleased if you had the time and inclination to do so. Nor do I expect you to just trust my conclusions. But that does not mean you should do nothing. The onus doesn't fall on me to show that Falun Gong practitioners are being killed for their organs. I do not have to explain where China gets its organs for transplants. China does. It falls to the government of China to explain the sourcing for their organs. The World Health Organization has adopted as a guiding principle on organ transplantation traceability and transparency, and that simply doesn't exist.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a talk given a few weeks ago by the people who've led investigations that have revealed China's prisoner organ transplant program. They spoke in depth about this disturbing practice and how many persecuted members of China's Falun Gong group have also fallen victim to this practice. Last year, the U.S. House of Representatives passed Resolution 281, expressing concern over persistent and credible reports of systemic, state-sanctioned organ harvesting from non-consenting prisoners of conscience in the People's Republic of China. The resolution also addressed concerns that large numbers of Falun Gong practitioners imprisoned for their religious beliefs and members of other religious and ethnic minority groups were becoming forced organ donors. Again, this is Damon Noto, a doctor at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey and spokesman for the group Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting. He says although Chinese officials have promised to stop the practice, it continues.
So the question is why? Why do they continue? Well, as David Matisse said, this is extremely profitable business. Very, very profitable. If you look at some of the numbers they talk about on the Chinese website, $60,000 for a kidney, $100,000 for liver. Some of the hospitals were saying it's their number one source of income. Very profitable. You know, this is one of the charts from I took from David Mattis's book, and that, you look at corneas, $30,000, hearts, $150,000. These were their websites giving quoting prices of what they were charging. Recently, there's some NGOs looked at numbers, and they said, one of the NGOs said there's about 115,000 organ transplants that take place every year, and that was a number from 2012. The World Health Organization says about 10% of those are illegal organ transplants. And if you look at that, 10%, just that 10%, you're looking at generating an income of about $600 million to $1.2 billion annually. So we're talking huge business, huge. One of the things that concerned medical doctors tremendously, what we're talking about here, is the time frame. If you look at transplanting organs in the U.S., you know, a liver is about a year. Canada is about 3.5 years for a kidney. But if you looked at Chinese websites, all over the place they were saying 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So the doctors kept saying, how the hell is this possible that you can transplant people so quickly? You don't even know who the patient is yet, but if you're guaranteeing them they're going over there, how can you get them this organ so quickly? This was a snapshot of one of the websites, a Chinese website, saying that their time period for liver was 1 week. And in their reports and in their media, they were saying that they did a heart transplant in 2006 in 24 hours. Young girl came into the hospital, 24 hours, they found a heart transplant for her. So they started thinking, well, how is this possible? Well, if you know China, if you look at the numbers, this is not my numbers, but different people have looked at it, China executes more people every year than the whole world combined. All countries combined, still way less than China. Saying that the exact number is a state secret. They don't just go out and say we did 10,000 this year or 5,000. Amnesty International tried to look at the numbers, and they came up with, 1,700, 2,000. That was in the early 2000s. Other organizations have tried to estimate numbers. Some said up to 8,000 is happening. But no matter what the number is, no one has come up with a number that equals the amount of transplants they do each year. So there became a discrepancy of the numbers. And the other thing that was concerning was, in China, if you are convicted of a crime and you're going to get executed, which is over 50 offenses, even minor offenses, if you're going to get executed, they have to execute you within 7 days. So you get convicted, and with a very short period of time, you're executed. So it's not like China states where it's like America, where you're put on death row and you sit there for years. In China, that system wasn't in place. They were supposed to be executing their people very quickly. So there became a big number differential that became difficult to explain. China then said that because they were executing so many people, that they were going to decrease the amount of people they executed each year. And the Wall Street Journal did numbers, and they showed a graph that every year from 2000, their numbers were going down. They were decreasing the amount of offenses, making it more difficult to be convicted of this type of crime where you'd be executed. But the problem was, as their numbers were going down for executions, the transplant numbers were going up. That was a big issue. Second issue was, even if they said, you know what, we executed 10,000 this year and we transplanted 10,000, well, there's a problem there too, because not everybody could be a good donor. You have to be healthy. You have to be the right blood type. You can't have anything like hepatitis. You have to be kind of the same size as the person. So not everybody is going to be a great candidate for transplantation. So the numbers didn't add up, and then we had different people look at, well, if there's a discrepancy in number, where are they coming from? And that's where David Mattis, David Kilgore's investigation, other people, Ethan Gutman that he had spoken about, people looked into these numbers and tried to figure out where these extra organ transplantations being done, where were these people coming from? And if you look at the numbers, and David Kilgore and David Mattis's numbers, was between 2000 and 2004, there was over 40,000 unexplained organ transplants that took place. And if you look at Gutman's numbers and his numbers from 2000 to 2008, there was over 65,000 people who got organs from unexplained sources. So the best source we could come up with was prisoners of conscience. And there's many reasons for that. And David went into why Falun Gong, this particular group, was a big candidate for being one of the main culprits or main people who were suffering under this system. But there's one thing I'd like to explain about China's. China has something called the Laogai system, and it's basically their prison system. But it's more complicated than just prisons. Their Laogai system is made up of prisons, detention centers, black jails, forced labor camps, military facilities, psychiatric institutions, and different organizations have looked at how many people are sitting in these Laogai facilities from year to year. And some of the numbers we've gotten is about, at any given time, there's about 3 to 5 million people sitting in these systems. And when the persecution of Falun Gong started from 1999 to 2000, there was an estimated 2 million Falun Gong practitioners that got put into this system. And after that, there has been an estimated 450,000 to a million Falun Gong practitioners at any given time sitting in this Laogai system. So I'm not going to get into what Falun Gong is, as it was just covered, but they're a particularly vulnerable group, considered enemy of the state. And one thing that was just mentioned was when you interviewed these people, they commonly had serial tests done, blood tests, urine tests, x-rays, ultrasounds, which made absolutely no sense. While other prisoners of conscience and even other prisoners, they weren't getting these types of tests. So it became very suspicious. In dealing with China, one of the people that's been dealing in the medical community is this guy Huang Jiefu, and he was the Vice Minister of Health at the time David Kilgore and David Mattis's report came out. And there's a couple interesting quotes I'd like to use from him. He's a transplant surgeon. He's done over, in 1 year, he did over 500 liver transplant operations, saying that only one of them was donated by a citizen, saying that he did about 499 transplant some executed prisoners himself. And then he said at another time, the struggle against Falun Gong is a serious political campaign. We must not be merciful to the few active members. That was in China's own People's Daily newspaper, he stated that. And then in 2012, when interviewed, why shouldn't we use condemned prisoners as organs? And he said one of the major reasons is because they carry infections, not because it's inhumane. And then recently, China has stated that they have no, although they're telling us they want to stop this practice, their director of the organ transplant system basically said at this point they have no date where they're going to wean off of using executed prisoners.
The question is, can something be done ethically?
Dr. Kirk Allison is a physician at the University of Minnesota's Program in Health and Human Rights. He's testified to the U.S. House Committee on International Relations about forced organ harvesting in China.
Now, international response, constructive engagement, moratoria. So here's the thing. The question, do you feed the capacity or not? And the Transplantation Society said it's opposed to all of this prisoner harvesting, but its membership is open to MDs who signed the statement. But Chinese MDs who participate in executive and transplants may register for meetings so they can come and get further education with the hope of influencing them. So it's okay to accept trainees from programs that use executee organs. So this is 2006. So this is the time when the capacity, when it's admitted that 95% of the organs are coming from executed people, the Transplant Society, in trying to influence, is actually expanding the capacity of processing people that are being killed and having their organs taken. Should the transplant members accept invitations to go and share their expertise to support transplant activities in China? Yes, if they're given insurances. Okay, this is extraordinary weak stuff. And as David mentioned, the Queensland Hospital chose to cut off all training. Art Kaplan and Gabriel Dunovich and others called for a time to boycott Chinese science. And in terms of things related to transplantation, there's been boycotts and also blocking of publications. Now, this is what not to do. Professor Chen Jinghua awarded the International Distinguished Medal by the American National Kidney Foundation in 2002. Here's the University of Minnesota, my own institution. An honorary doctorate from the Ministry of Health, Dr. Chen Zhu. And the University of Sydney, there was an attempt to have his honorary doctorate and his position revoked. The new announced policy was welcomed by the Transplantation Society as if it was a de facto reality on the ground. But as mentioned by David Mattis, they came out with a statement, China is still the only country in the world that systematically takes organs from executed prisoners for the purpose of transplantation. So my statement is this. Transplantation, when done right and ethically, is a wonderful thing, but no culture or state is required to have a transplantation system, even if patients that would otherwise die would live longer. The populace needs to come to the conclusion, does it want to participate in an ethical system or not? And the way to press this is to say, cut off all the unethical. Then you're faced with the opportunity cost. Do you want to be in or do you not want to be in? But this gradualism has only succeeded in dragging out all thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of execution, and that is no exaggeration, that is an understatement, year by year, have continued to take place. So my modest thesis and proposal, the gradualist approach in every quarter, this side, that side of the ocean, is the single greatest impediment to a voluntary system in China. If the culture of China does not value transplantation to the degree of voluntary, it need not have a solid organ transplant system. That's okay. That is, in my view, ethically acceptable. And physicians who are transplant physicians can retrain into other functions, such as public health physicians. Dr. Martin Luther King stated, this is no time to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. And I think this is a great example for that.
That's Dr. Kirk Allison. Finally, David Mattis, who spoke earlier in the program, spoke about what he believes can be done by U.S. medical and academic institutions to directly address the issue of forced organ harvesting from prisoners in China.
So that's kind of a brief summary of the evidence. I wanted to move on to the next topic of what Utah can do about all this. And I have four suggestions to make. One is that the University of Utah should close its Confucius Institute. McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, decided to close its Confucius Institute. It closed the institute this year. It had hosted the institute, actually it was last year, it had hosted the institute since 2008. And there had to be 6 months' notice of termination, and they gave it. Now, the headquarter for Confucius Institute is in China. It's called Hanban, and Hanban has a hiring policy to exclude anybody who practices Falun Gong. And the reason that McMaster University closed down the Confucius Institute is it determined that that hiring policy obviously violated its principles of equality. Now, the way the eviction came about was that there was a woman named Sonia Zhao, who was an employee of the Confucius Institute at McMaster University and a Falun Gong practitioner. When she was in China before joining the Institute, she had to sign a statement promising not to practice Falun Gong. And when she got to Canada, she made a complaint against McMaster University to the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, and the complaint was settled, and I was her lawyer for that complaint. The Institute was closed, and after it was closed, the Canadian Association of University Teachers urged all Canadian universities and colleges in December 2013, urged them to end ties with Confucius Institutes. The executive director of the Canadian Association of University Teachers said, and I quote, "In agreeing to host Confucius Institutes, Canadian universities and colleges are compromising their integrity by allowing the Chinese Language Cultural International to have a voice in a number of academic matters such as curriculums, texts, and topics of class discussion. Such interference is a fundamental violation of academic freedom. Simply put, Confucius Institutes are owned and operated by an authoritarian government and beholden to its politics." Now, the University of Utah, I'm pleased to see, has an equal opportunity and non-discrimination employment policy. The university, I'm confident, if it investigates the matter, will find that its Confucius Institute functions in violation of the policy by discriminating and hiring against Falun Gong, as McMaster University has done. The university should not maintain the institute in violation of that policy. I should say that when I originally did this complaint with Sonia Zhao, the discrimination policy was part of the Hanban website. After we pressed the matter, they took it down from the website in English, but it was still there in Spanish the last time I looked. The second suggestion I make has to do with the University of Utah Transplant Center. That center needs to develop a policy of not training any Chinese surgeon in any transplant surgical technique without a commitment that the trainee will not engage in organ transplant abuse. Now, in Australia, the hospitals have gone even further than that. In Queensland, the Prince Charles Hospital has a policy of not training any Chinese surgeon in any transplant surgical technique, period. And that's in writing. The other hospitals in Australia and the other states in Australia, I'm told, have the same policies, although they haven't committed it to writing. There's an academic article by some transplant surgeons where they state this principle that training of Chinese transplant professionals by the international community must be conditioned on commitments that trainees will not engage directly or indirectly in the use of organs from executed prisoners. At the very least, the transplant center in Utah needs a policy of that sort, that it will not train Chinese transplant professionals unless the trainees commit that they will not engage in the use of organs from prisoners. Third suggestion I make for Utah, and this is for the Utah senators and representatives, to propose legislation to combat international transplant abuse. Now, there is already in the United States a National Organ Transplant Act from 1984, and that law prohibits the knowing purchase and sale of organs. But that law is territorial only. It applies to the purchase and sale of organs within the territory of the United States. So if somebody goes to China and buys an organ and then comes back to the United States, that's not a violation of the National Organ Transplant Law. The law has to be changed, so it would become a violation. And even if one doesn't want to prosecute patients, one should be able to prosecute brokers. There is already similar legislation for sex tourism, for sex trafficking, that has extraterritorial effect, and it should be a simple matter to enact similar legislation for transplant tourism. Now, the fourth policy suggestion I make is an evolution of transplant ethics. There are some already transplant ethics of the American Medical Association, but they're very simple, short, rudimentary. There's seven principles. I have 27 others to add to that. But Kirk Allison is going to talk to you about that, so I'm not going to mention any of the 27, although they're in the written text if you want them. So by conclusion, I will say that the ability of those outside of China to stop the killing in China of prisoners for their organs is limited. Yet there are two practical steps we can take. One is to do nothing to be complicit in the Chinese abuse. The second is to avoid giving any status to the abusers. A significant driver for change of transplant practices in China is the desire to achieve international respectability. Giving Chinese transplant professionals any form of international status while transplant abuse continues in China undermines the effort to end the abuse. Thank you very much.
That's David Mattis. You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. Thank you to David Mattis, Dr. Damon Noto, and Dr. Kirk Allison. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website, and follow this program on Twitter at @KCPWHinckley. Join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.